content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Ed Tremblay from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the Tar Heel Junior Historian magazine, North Carolina History for Students. Reading from Volume 64, Number 1, the Fall 2024 edition of the Tar Heel Junior Historian, Carolina Critters, Animals, and People in North Carolina History. And we're going to begin with, so, what exactly is an animal? Generally speaking, animals are organisms that, one, need to eat. They can't produce their own energy like plants doing photosynthesis. 2. Move. Sometimes these are very small movements. Think coral or sponges. Yes, they are animals. 3. Have sexual reproduction. In order to produce offspring, animals usually must combine the genetic information from two individuals of different sexes. 4. Are multicellular, made up of many cells. Note, animals are different from bacteria, which are unicellular, having only one cell. There are many millions of species of animals on Earth, and many thousands of new ones are described each year. It's important to remember that we, as humans, Homo sapiens, are just one of them. And this sidebar comes with a diagram, some of the animals roaming these lands in the early 1700s. Illustration from the book A New Voyage to Carolina, containing the exact description and natural history of that country, together with the present state thereof, and a journal of 1,000 miles traveled through several nations of Indians, 1709, by John Lawson, who was born in 1674 and died in 1711. There's another sidebar. How do museums get started? Do you have a prized collection of something at home, maybe a rock collection or shells, or maybe you collect baseball or Pokemon cards? Did you know that more often than not, museums get their start as someone's personal collection? That was the case for our oldest museum here in North Carolina, the North Carolina State Museum, now known as the NC Museum of Natural Sciences. It began in 1879 when the collections of state geologist Washington Carruthers Carr, rocks, minerals, fossils, and different types of woods, and Commissioner of Agriculture Leonidas Lafayette Polk, agricultural products, were combined under one roof. Later in 1887, the North Carolina General Assembly officially established the State Museum to illustrate the agricultural and other resources and the natural history of this state. Did you know that you can still visit some of the same specimens that were on display for families in the late 1800s? The collection of 12-inch diameter polished stones representing different rock types from across North Carolina is still in the gallery today on the second floor. That collection also traveled to represent North Carolina at the 1893 Chicago World's Fair. So is Mayflower, a right whale whose skeleton was donated to the museum in 1876, long before there was even a building to house the bones. That skeleton hangs above your head as you enter the Coastal Carolina Hall on the first floor. Not long after, these initial collections were greatly improved upon and added to by two industrious brothers, Herbert Hutchinson, H.H., and Clement Samuel, C.S., Brimley from England. There are a couple of photographs, museum specimens at the Museum of Natural History, now the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences, circa 1900. And Herbert Hutchinson, H.H. Brimley, pictured here in 1936, served as director of the North Carolina Museum of Natural History from 1895 to 1946. Next article is Carolina Parakeets, by John Connors, who retired from the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences, where he was the coordinator of the Naturalist Center. He continues leading nature hikes, giving presentations, doing inventories of nature in local parks, and playing with his 5 grandchildren. His children book, The Great Big Buzz Off is nearing publication. Imagine for a moment that you're in a quiet swamp when suddenly you hear it, a harsh screeching sound. Then you see them darting through the sky in your direction. There must be dozens, green birds with long tails. Their heads glow yellow, and their eyes are framed in fiery orange. They land in a bald cypress tree across the dark waters of the lagoon separating them from you. Close your eyes for a moment and imagine seeing them. The birds gather at the cones hanging from the branches of the cypress and noisily rip them apart with their strong, hooked beaks. Some are hanging upside down, while others are sidestepping on the branches from one cone to another. Suddenly, as a breeze sweeps through the trees, whoosh, the flock departs, loudly screeching as they go. The Carolina parakeets are gone forever. Sadly, that part is true. The only North American parrot species whose range was entirely north of the Mexican border, the North Carolina parakeet, Conuropsis carolinensis, is now extinct. No one will ever hear or see them in the wild again. The last known was a caged bird named Incus in the possession of the Cincinnati Zoo. He had been acquired along with 15 others for $40, which was equivalent to $1,200 in 2022, around 1885, with the hopes of breeding them to stabilize the population. He had a mate, Lady Martha, who laid many eggs. But the couple were poorly equipped parents, and they shoved their eggs from the nest. The staff at the zoo failed to incubate these eggs and foster chicks, so there were no offspring. Lady Martha died in 1917. Incus followed in 1918, the last of his kind. What we are left with are relics of the real bird, hundreds of mounts and scientific specimens in museum collections created by taxidermy, which is the art of preserving dead animals by preparing, stuffing, and mounting them in order to retain a lifelike appearance for display. We also have paintings and written accounts of the birds from people who once witnessed them. One of the naturalists to describe the Carolina parakeet was John Lawson, born in 1674 and died in 1711, Surveyor General of North Carolina. A naturalist is a person who studies natural history, which is the scientific study of animals or plants. He traveled 500 miles from the coast through central North Carolina, led by several indigenous guides, including Eno Will. In 1709, he published A New Voyage to Carolina, in which he wrote about the parakeets. They visit us first when mulberries are ripe, which fruit they love extremely. They are mischievous to orchards. They are often taken alive and will become familiar and tame in 2 days. Several decades later, English naturalist Mark Catesby, born 1683, died 1749, traveled across North Carolina. He drafted the first scientific description of the parakeet in his publication Natural History of Carolina, Florida, and the Bahama Islands, 1731 to 1743. The following accompanied his colored drawing. They feed on seeds and kernels of fruit, particularly those of cypress and apples. The orchards in autumn are visited by numerous flights of them where they make great destruction. Descriptions offered by these and others yield clues as to where and how Carolina parakeets lived. They preferred old-growth wetland forests and were most numerous in southern swamps and river floodplains, where bald cypress, swamp tupelo, and sycamore were long-lived dominant trees. They ate the seeds of trees and weedy plants like cocklebur and thistle, and fruit including those planted by settlers. Despite the name Carolina parakeet, Florida and the lower Mississippi states were their true population centers. Although colorful and interesting birds, they were considered pests by settlers. Another naturalist who wrote about parakeets was Alexander Wilson, born 1766, died 1813, a Scottish-born poet and teacher. He came to America in 1802 and befriended William Bartram, who was a native-born botanist. Bartram taught Wilson the basics of ornithology, which is the study of birds. A person who studies birds is an ornithologist. Wilson then began his exploration, cataloging and painting the bird life of America. He published a 9-volume set between 1807 and 1813 called The American Ornithology, or The Natural History of Birds of the United States. Since there were no cameras to capture detail for his paintings, Wilson would have to shoot subjects to draw from real life. While collecting parakeets at Big Bone Lick near the Kentucky River in 1810, Wilson noticed an odd behavior. Having shot down a number, some of which were only wounded, the whole flock swept round their prostrate companions and again settled on a low tree within 20 yards of the spot where I stood. This behavior made them easier targets for farmers eager to shoot and get rid of them, and helps explain how populations could drop so rapidly around pioneer settlements. As he traveled up the Mississippi River drainage, Wilson made a pet of a Carolina parakeet he wounded. He named it Pole and traveled for months across hundreds of miles with a parakeet in his pocket or sitting on his shoulder. He wrote to a friend, "My parakeet is my faithful companion yet, and I shall try hard to bring him home with me." Unfortunately, Pole fell overboard and drowned in the Gulf of Mexico as Wilson returned to Philadelphia by ship. John James Audubon, born 1785, died 1851, also encountered parakeets on his travels. He published a brilliant portfolio of paintings, The Birds of America, 1827 to 1838, where the living bird is depicted in action in its natural habitat. His 7 Carolina parakeets are seen in various postures feeding on cockleburrs in Louisiana. Audubon's detailed journal captured the species' decline. "Our parakeets are very rapidly diminishing in number, and in some districts where 25 years ago they were plentiful, scarcely any are now to be seen." Neither Wilson nor Audubon were trained scientists. They were explorers who kept notes and painted wildlife portraits for benefactors who purchased their art. It is doubtful that they realized their journal pages would provide the historical account of the Carolina parakeet. All through the 1800s, settlers continued to shoot parakeets. Loggers cut down the old-growth forest, and plume hunters collected their feathers for women's garments. By mid-century, the parakeets were reported rarely outside of Florida. The last wild flock was 12 individuals seen in Okeechobee County, Florida, in 1904. 4 were shot for museum collections. The American Ornithological Society declared the species extinct in 1939. Is that the end of their story? It may not be. There are several closely related species in Mexico and Central America. The rapidly emerging CRISPR technology, using DNA from one species and introducing it to the eggs of a closely related species to develop viable offspring of the first, is being considered for several species of extinct animals, including birds like the dodo. Could the Carolina parakeet be a candidate? Time alone will tell. Here are the captions accompanying the photographs and other drawings that are with this article. An illustration from Frank Leslie's Illustrated Newspaper, November 10, 1883, labeled "The Cruelties of Fashion, Fine Feathers Make Fine Birds." In the late 1800s, birds and feathers became all the rage, from fashion to home decor to fly fishing. Sometimes even whole birds were used. But this editorial drawing shows that even then, some people were starting to protest the practice. The Carolina parakeet's colorful feathers made them a popular choice for decorating women's hats. These feathers from the museum's collection adorn a green velvet hat, possibly worn by Pearl Weathers Smith of Shelby, circa 1909. John James Audubon's Carolina parrot, the bird now known as a Carolina parakeet, plate number 26 from the Birds of America, a collection of 435 life-size prints created between 1827 and 1838. This 1700 painting is believed to be a portrait of John Lawson, born 1674, died 1711, a young British explorer who wrote about his travels in a new voyage to Carolina. He later helped settle the towns of Bath and New Bern and became the first surveyor general of North Carolina. Alexander Wilson, born 1766, died 1813, was a Scottish-American naturalist and illustrator known as the father of American ornithology. John James Audubon was a naturalist and painter who published for his work in the Birds of America, in which the living bird depicted life-size is in action in his natural habitat. The National Audubon Society, an organization dedicated to the conservation of birds, was named in his honor. The next article is Whales and Whaling in North Carolina by Lisa L. Gattens, who is collection manager for the Mammalogy Research Collection with the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences. The collection houses everything from great whales to tiny shrews. Did you know that there are more than 30 species of whales that can be found off the coast of North Carolina? Whales are divided into two groups or suborders depending on how they feed. Toothed whales, as the name suggests, have teeth that are used to capture and consume prey. Sperm whales, like the one made famous in the classic book Moby Dick or the Whale, 1851, are an example of toothed whales. Baleen whales do not have teeth. They filter krill and small fish through plates of baleen that are lined along their upper jaws. The North Atlantic right whale is one of the baleen whales found off our coast and now is of greatest conservation concern. By the way, baleen is the bony, flexible strips in the upper jaws of whales that they use to strain large amounts of small food such as shrimp from the water. Some whale species migrate along our coast and swim close to shore. Others stay farther out in the open ocean. It is likely that indigenous people living in North Carolina hunted whales for generations. Long before arriving in this country, Europeans also hunted whales in waters off northern Europe. Whales were considered an important food source for thousands of years. The blubber, the thick layer of fat under the skin, was rendered into oil. Whale oil was used in soap, margarine, and as fuel for oil-burning lamps. Baleen, which is made of keratin, like our hair and fingernails, was used in making baskets, umbrellas, fishing poles, and clothing, among other things. So when early European colonists arrived in North America, they brought their knowledge and skill for hunting whales. They immediately began to harvest whales that had beached, as well as to hunt them from the water. Harvesting of whales off North Carolina's coast was greatest in the mid-1800s, and then declined as fewer whales were found near shore. Whale populations continued to decline worldwide, and in 1946, the International Whaling Commission was established to protect whale populations from over-harvesting. The Marine Mammal Protection Act was established in 1972 to provide protection to whales and all marine mammals. Now the practice of hunting whales for food or other resources is done only in Iceland, Norway, and Japan. As an important part of their heritage and culture, some native people in Canada and the U.S. states of Alaska and Washington also participate in harvesting a small number of whales each year. While any whale species was considered suitable for hunting, one species was favored above the others, the North Atlantic right whale. Right whales swim close to shore and are easier to harvest. They are large and can provide a lot of oil for fuel and baleen for manufacturing. So they were considered the right whale to hunt, and that name stuck. This led to a drastic decline in the population of this species. By the early 1900s, there were fewer than 100 North Atlantic right whales. Since the passing of the Endangered Species Act and the Marine Mammal Protection Act, the population of North Atlantic right whales has increased, but they are still at serious risk of extinction. Now the main causes of injury and death are from becoming entangled in fishing gear and from collisions with boats. Fishing gear can get wrapped around their flippers or tail fluke and prevent them from being able to swim. Being hit by boats as small as 30 feet can be fatal, especially for very young whales. Now there are rules that require boats to travel more slowly in areas where right whales hang out. There are only about 350 individuals now. Because there are so few, scientists monitor each of them. Early in 2004, a right whale was hit by a ship off the North Carolina coast. This specimen was known as Stumpy by scientists who had monitored her for 30 years. She was given the nickname because she was missing a part of her tail fluke, probably from a previous collision with a ship. She was an adult when she was first spotted, so this means she was at least 40 years old when she died. She had given birth at least 5 times. Researchers took many measurements of her bones to better understand what makes boat collisions fatal. This research led to the change in speed limits for boats in important right whale habitats and helped prevent more whales being killed by boats. The skeleton of this specimen is on exhibit in the Nature Research Center of the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences. Here are the captions with the accompanying photographs. A humpback whale uses its baleen to fish for food. This colored engraving, Whale Fishery Attacking a Right Whale, shows a crew in a small whaling boat launched from a larger sailing ship in the mid-1800s, imaged by Currier and Ives. You can go see this exhibit featuring the skeleton of Stumpy, a North Carolina right whale, at the North Atlantic right whale at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences in Raleigh. There's also a sidebar, check it out. In the 1800s, whalebone was an important item in women's fashion, but it wasn't really bone, it was baleen. Baleen, flexible but strong, was used to create shape in corsets, collars, and hoop skirts. And there's a photograph with this. Caroline Barker, a collections specialist at the Museum of the Albemarle in Elizabeth City, points out some baleen stays poking out of the worn bodice of a black Victoria-era woman's jacket. And this blue woman's jacket from sometime between 1880 to 1890 shows how far the black jacket might have been worn. Next, can you find the hidden animals? Quilts tell stories and reveal voices from the past, especially women's voices. What does this 1896 crazy quilt from the museum's collection tell you about the woman who made it? Take a closer look. Can you find in the quilt's design all of the animals that are displayed separately on the sides, the quilter's initial and her name spelled out, the date she completed the quilt, one more animal not displayed on the side? Who do you think is missing? A crazy quilt is a bed cover made of irregularly shaped fabric pieces, typically including silks and velvets, and decorated with embroidery, painting, and/or appliques. About the artist. When Sally Fisher, born 1870, died 1910, began her elaborate crazy quilt in the mid-1890s, she likely had no idea that one day it would belong to a museum. Unmarried in her late 20s, Fisher had time to devote to fancy work and crazy patchwork, a fashionable ornamental quilting trend born in the late 1870s, and remained a popular way to showcase fine sewing skills. Though she used sensible wools and cottons alongside a few pieces of silk satins and velvets, Fisher took as much care with her quilt as any elite needleworker. She delicately embroidered the seams with elaborate feather and herringbone stitches. She created lifelike flowers and used common Victorian symbols like a sheaf of wheat for abundance and an anchor for hope, to display her aspirations. She also included farm animals, pigs, chickens, and horses, that may have called to mind her Catawba County home. She personalized the quilt with her name, Sally, along with the date of completion, 1896. And now, stories from our collection. A pincushion from the late 1800s to early 1900s. Today, most people don't use pincushions, but in the 1800s and 1900s, pincushions were everyday objects and were often decorative or funny. Pincushions held pins stuck into a tight, cushy area, upright, and at the ready for a sewer to grab so they could pin fabric in place until it was stitched. But why an alligator pincushion? Was this a gift for someone who loved reptiles? A souvenir from a trip to Florida? Your guess is as good as ours. Bird decoys from the 1990s. Are these decoys tools or art? For generations, hunters have used basic models to lure fowl close to their hunting blinds. But today, many collectors just love the look of decoys and buy them to display. Nick Sapone of Dare County made this white swan from wood and canvas stretched over a wire frame. In 1995, North Carolina Heritage Award winner Homer Fulcher of Carteret County carved and painted the solid wood decoy to look like a redhead drake. Needlework picture, 1820s. Do your art projects always come out perfect? Mary Fort stitched this piece probably when she was a teenager studying at the Raleigh Academy. It features the Greek goddess Sibylla, who was often pictured riding in a chariot led by lions. Mary, or perhaps her teacher, painted the detailed areas such as Sibylla's face, the cherub, that naked baby angel, and the lion's faces. But since their manes don't reach all the way around their heads, the lions do look a little bit like tigers with beards. Wooden toys, circa 1919 to 1921. This Tryon Toymaker's Mountain Home playset was hand-carved and painted by a teenager. Eleanor Vance and Charlotte Yale founded a toy-making business in the North Carolina mountains in 1915 with the aim of teaching local young people artistic skills that could help them earn a living. Fun fact, the hinged cabin roof in this set lifts up so that the other pieces could be played with or stored inside the house. We've run out of time for today's episode of North Carolina History. Be sure to listen next time. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Ed Tremblay, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.